She's winding up. She's getting to second, but Pride of Jenny at the 200. My goodness, 15 in front. Declan Bates goes for the whip, riding a ride out. There's no need. This is a demolition job. Pride of Jenny in the Queen Elizabeth Stakes. My, oh, my.
G'day, listeners. Welcome to another episode of the Triple J Racing Podcast. I'm really excited about today's episode. I'm joined by Queensland racing trainer Jack Bruce. Big thank you for taking time out of your day, mate. And you've got a lovely setting there on the side of the Deegan racetrack. How are you today?
Yeah, good. Thanks, Jared. Thanks very much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here. And yeah, this is a nice cruisy afternoon. Sitting here, got the racetrack in the background, and looking forward to catching up and talking all things racing.
Yeah, beautiful. It's going to be great, mate. And you mentioned to me earlier that you might have ducked out the Kalora Lodge to check on a couple of spellers out there. Obviously, track work in the morning, so certainly a busy period for yourself. But how were all the horses looking out there at the lodge today?
Yeah, good. Yeah, really good. I like to make a routine habit of going and seeing the spellers and the breakers. This time of year, I've got about five or six being broken in at the moment at Kalora, so it's nice to go and check in on their progress. They're in week number two and just make sure that they're as they should be. They're looking good in condition and their coats are good and they're handling everything, and just get a few videos for the clients and also chat to the breakers, because you sort of seem to get a little bit more out of them face to face when you can have those discussions and see how they're tracking. But all is well. It's only about an hour away from my stables at Deegan, so I can duck out there, check in on the horses and be back in the office in time for this. It's very good.
Yeah, perfect, mate. It's a lovely setting out there at Kalora Lodge, so happy days there. And obviously, it's been a really busy period with the yearling sales, and I know you made a couple of nice purchases up there at the Magic Millions sale and also the English Classic sale recently, so you must be very excited about that. I'm a big fan of the Cool Azabel and Cross Stitch Cult, so what can you tell us about a couple of those horses from the Magic Millions?
Yeah, it's a busy time of year. Magic Millions was the first cab off the rank in January, and I bought a Cool Azabel colt, about 140 for him, and he's a good, solid, strong colt. The stallion is doing really well. He had Cobra Club that ran second in the English Nursery, and he had Cool Archie that qualified for the Magic Millions and ran well on the BJ McLaughlin. So you've got a stallion whose second season, the two-year-olds are up and running, which would... He was a good two-year-old in New Zealand, Cool Azabel, but really he would train on at threes, that Savabel line. So to be able to buy a colt by a stallion who's going well early in his career, I think I've got him in at the right price point. And when I'm at the yearling sales, really in terms of what I'm selling to clients, I'm focusing on under 200,000. That's really the goal, to try and be able to find a nice horse for that price. And when you're shopping around at all the sales throughout the year, there's many opportunities in that bracket. And obviously it would be nice to spend $1 million on a horse, but I think for what I'm looking for and the backing I have, there's plenty of value and there's plenty of good horses that come out of that bracket. So you're certainly not missing out on anything if you don't have sort of 10% of 800,000 to spend. You can certainly buy a really nice horse in that bracket, and I'm hopeful that I've done so.
Yeah, absolutely. It looks like you've purchased really well there. And on that note, obviously going into the yearling sales, the books come out early. You can have a look at the backgrounds and the pedigrees, and then you come up with a bit of a short list and identify which horses you want to go and inspect. And then there's the X-rays and all that sort of stuff to go over. So was that something you were looking for this year? A nice second season sire, colt or filly, or was it sort of what goes on? How do you start the process from right at the start with the book and then right through to inspections?
Yeah, we start with the book, and I'm fortunate I team up with Jim Clark, who's a bloodstock agent, and he buys for a few main clients, of which I am one. He buys for Bjorn Baker. He does Ridgemont Farms work, and he also buys for a private client at the Sunshine Coast as well. So he has a very good handle on the whole catalogue. So I start with him basically, and he's looked at every horse on the complex. So he shortlists for me, and then I have a view in my mind of what I'm looking for. You talk about stallions. I know what stallions I like. I know what stallions I don't like. And there's a saying, trainers say, oh, this horse has got a bloodstock agent's head, which means the bloodstock agent only has to look at it once at the sales, and you've got to train it for the rest of its life and look at it every day. So there's a yin and yang balance between what Jim will suggest to me and then what I like. But essentially, I'm utilizing his services. He knows what roughly what I like and what I don't. So I'm using him to cut the list down into price brackets and into stallions that I like and pedigrees that I've had success with. And Jim's a very good judge of a horse physically. So I get those horses that won't make my physical grade removed for me before I get to the complex. And then I'm looking at a much smaller number. At Magic Millions, you have 1,000 horses. I'm probably looking at 100. So it's really good to be able to chop it down like that. And I bought a Wild Ruler colt out of book two. And when we're sitting down with Jim, he said, "Oh, you want to go and look at this lot, whatever it is?" And I said, "No Wild Rulers. I don't want any Wild Rulers." And he said, "You need to go and see it." So he kicked me up the backside. Down we went. I loved the horse and I bought it. So this is why it's so good to have, great minds think alike, but the teamwork structure of how we approach the sales, it takes in his breadth of experience along with what I like and what I have had experience training and what I enjoy training. And then also I know in my mind what my clients want. So we combine our forces and go through it that way. And he looks at everything. He's basically the first look man, and then he trims it into second looks and third looks and fourth looks. Basically, I'm sort of coming in at the seconds, thirds, and fourth stage. And at any given day, we've probably got about four or five or six on the list that we've vetted and that we're bidding on. So you end up bidding on quite a lot of horses, and you ne this is not necessarily secure them all. Sometimes you miss out, and I've had that at sales. I've bought on day three and four of the sale when I've had horses on my list early. But it's important to stick to your game plan. Don't pay overs. Just buy what you like and what fits within your clients' budgets. And if you do that often enough, you'll invariably have some success.
Yeah, absolutely. And you only paid $26,000 for that Wild Ruler colt, out of Rapid Response. So hopefully a good result there for the team. And obviously, as you said, Jim's got a really re good record, and I'm hoping that he's found us a nice all too hard filly with Bjorn Baker as well. We sort of
Well,
opened up.
absolutely, he will have. He will have. And he's got the good eye, he's got the experience, and he's doing this for a living. He's looking at horses every week of his life, all the time. He's looking at an entire Magic Millions catalogue for the last however many years. So he knows those. And obviously he bought Steffi Magnetica for Ridgemont and Bjørn by All Too Hard, that won a Stradbroke and will be ran in an Everest and has won plenty of money. So yeah, he's a good judge of a horse, and it's really important to have him on your team.
Yeah, awesome. And without me going too far, back into the history books the last couple of years, would this be probably your best year, or most exciting year, starting with the yearlings? Or, have you spent more money this year, or is it sort of on par with recent years?
Yeah, it is. This will be my best year of yearling purchases for sure. When I first started training, I sort of wasn't well known, and there probably weren't people jumping out of trees to send me yearlings. So I went and bought a couple myself, and I was supported by a little core of clients, but I didn't buy widely. And one of those horses sort of ended up winning 100 grand in about four runs as a young horse. And I had bits and bobs of success. I had a slow one too that ended up going to Roma and having about 20 starts and not breaking the bank at all. But most importantly, I told everyone it was slow very early on, apologized, and we moved on. So it's a good game, but every year I've stepped it up. Last year I paid $200,000 for a King's Legacy filly, and she's showing me really good promise at the moment. So I'm feeling rewarded for, I suppose, the bigger balls to go and buy the horses I really, really want to train. I bought a horse called Mr. Democrat for 140, a better than ready, and he ran before Christmas as a 2-year-old. So I'm enjoying following these yearling purchases. And then this year I've probably stretched a little bit further. I'm still trying to keep it reasonable for what I can sell down and what my clients want to race, but I'm probably pushed the envelope out, and I've been a little bit ballsy with what I've bought, and I've spread the net a bit further too. I went to Classic this year. I didn't go last year. So I've bought an Exceed and Excel and a Hellbent there. I've gone for the proven stallion pathway at that sale. And although those horses aren't CUTIS registered, which is important in Queensland, as Jim says to me, "Mate, when it wins the English Millennium, do you really care if it's CUTIS?"
Yeah, that's a good point, because you sort of do have to look at that with the extra added prize money. But if you find the right horse and things like that, then you can get the job done. And correct me if I'm wrong, but a lot of people don't realize you only really started your training operation in May 2022. Is that correct?
That's correct. Yeah, May 2022, I kicked off, and it was myself, my partner, and my father-in-law. We were in there, the three of us, going hard early days for sort of about 6 or 8 weeks, and then I employed my foreman after that, and we've grown from there. We started with 7 horses, and by the end of 2022, so what was probably about 5 or 6 months, I was bursting at the seams. I needed more stables, so I took a barn at the Sunshine Coast as well. So I've got 30 at Deegan and 30 at the Sunny Coast, and I fluctuated numbers. I had sort of a barn and a half up there at some stage, and I was training a lot of horses, but it was when I had an influx of horses after I'd started, and I'd hit the ground running, and I was on a roll really, and horses were coming in thick and fast. I was training them, and a lot of them were, I suppose, secondhand cars, as I would say. They'd come in from other places, and some of them didn't last very long in the system. But it was important to be able to accommodate them at that stage of my career and try and train a winner for people. That's what's important. That's what people want. And I've been to Gatton and Warwick and Kilcoy, and I've never seen an unhappy person in the winning owner's room. Never seen anyone in the corner crying into their free beer after they've won a race. So it's been good. And I last season I had a lot of winners, a good volume of winners, probably not the quality that I was looking for, but I did have 71. That was my second season, so that was a lot of winners. I'm probably training less horses now. I've just dropped back a little bit, and those lesser grades have sort of run their course and are applying their trade in Rocky and Roma and Mackay, and I'm sort of back with my younger stock coming through. And also the tried horses are important. They for me represent the bread and butter. That's the I suppose I call them stocking fillers sometimes. They come in, have their time in the stable. They come with good form from down south. They get a step back in grade in Queensland, and they're able to win a race that they otherwise may not have been able to do. And that's really important. It gives clients another option for their horses and means they can enjoy that horse for a little bit longer before they naturally need to be unsold.
Yeah, absolutely. And you made a really good point in there about winning races. It doesn't really, obviously the big thrill is everyone wants to win the Golden Slipper and be around. We can raise in the winner's room there. But I can vouch for it myself. When horses win anywhere, I absolutely love it, and I think everyone's the same. So if you're willing as a trainer to travel your horses and place them in the right races, then you're doing a great job. And obviously looking at your record, even I think your place strike rate at the moment's about 45%, so almost half of your horses are running in the top three, which is an excellent achievement. Obviously with these podcasts, I like to dive right back to the start as well, mate. So you're obviously a proud born and bred Kiwi. So whereabouts did you grow up in New Zealand, and did you spend a lot of your childhood there, or did you come out to Australia
Yeah, I
early?
grew up in the, no, not at all. I grew up in the Waikato, which is, for those of you who are unfamiliar with Deegan, the Waikato is dairying and horse country. The Cambridge Track, which is about 10 minutes from where I grew up, is the largest training centre in the Southern Hemisphere. So around the ready-to-run sales time, you've got about 1,100 horses in training at Cambridge. They have two tracks side by side. It's a big piece of property, and to put it in perspective, there's about 300 trained at Randwick, about 200 or 300 trained at Rose Hill. Warwick Farm has 700, so it's the biggest in Sydney. And Eagle Farm has 400 on-course boxes. The Sunny Coast has 400 on-course boxes. So Cambridge with 1,100 is a very big training centre. It's very diverse. It's got a lot of big trainers there. Like when I was growing up, Tony Pike was big, Chris Woods was big, Murray Baker was big, Stephen Marsh was big, Roger James was big, and that's a large volume of proper big trainers that have big strings of horses and work. So, yeah, Cambridge was a real mecca, and just down the road from that, you have Matamata, which is sort of similar. That's where Te Ākau is based. So, for those of you who've watched some New Zealand racing and seen those famous tangerine colours, they're based at Matamata with about 120 in work. So it's a very large operation. New Zealand's got a real thriving thoroughbred industry. There's a large appetite to race horses in there, and there's a real love for the sport in New Zealand. So that was really what I grew up with. My background was in farming. I worked at Windsor Park Stud. They stood High Chaparral in those days. That was their pin-up stallion, and he was the sire of Shootout, Monaco Consol. Those sorts of horses were all High Chap horses, and he's gone on to be a great stallion. He was whisked off to Coolmore pretty quickly after he stood at Windsor Park, but I think the farm did really well at standing him, and they've been able to be at the forefront of New Zealand breeding for decades and decades. So that was the Schick family. They gave me a start. They're about 20 minutes down the road. I kicked off there. I learned to put a head collar on a horse on that farm, and it's a very special place. I love going back and catching up with them and seeing them. They taught me well. It was a good, solid, old school grounding in horses. You were to work hard, you followed the rules, there was no nonsense. And I suppose that really helped me at the time. It was sort of something that kept me on the straight and narrow. And they didn't just teach me about horses, they taught me to work, which is irreplaceable and really important. It doesn't matter. I say this to my staff, it does not matter if you're going to be in horse racing, you want to play tiddlywinks, you're going to work at Coles, whatever you're going to do, if you're going to rise to the top of that, you need to have a work ethic. And so many cases of sports people that can't get to the level they want to because they just don't have it in them. So they were a good grounding, and farming in New Zealand was a good place to start. And it wasn't until I left New Zealand really that I started getting into the racing side of things and branching out a bit further.
Yeah, okay, mate. That's really a really good point you make. Obviously, learning how to work hard young, and that was obviously a really good experience for you there. So how old were you then when you were first around horses?
Well, so I went. My father always used to take me to the races. I had a very, he had a strong interest in racing. He was a breeder and he raced horses in partnership. And so he was always following it. And I'd always had that passion. But I went away to uni and I had a year off in the middle of it. I didn't sort of put a head collar on a horse really until then. Well, I did, but not in any sort of professional capacity until then. So that was where I really learned how to do it. So I was late. I wasn't a kid who was born into a racing family or riding at the age of 12 or 13. I wasn't that at all. I came to the practical side of horses a little bit later, but I was fortunate that I had good teachers, and that probably enabled me to make up a little bit for lost time. And that's when I really started to get interested in it, and I'd never really considered it a viable career option. I was still quite committed to going to university. I went back after I'd spent a year at the farm and I finished my uni, but I was looking around at jobs, and I got offered a job at Fulton Hogan. It's a big roading contractor in New Zealand. I went into their office and they basically like, the job's yours if you want it. But I went around this little rabbit warren in a dark, dingy corner of Hamilton, and I basically could catch depression in the corridors of the place. And I went home and I just thought about it. I said, I can't do this. I'm going back to the farm. So I basically gave up a nice paying graduate job. I went back to the farm for 30 grand a year to ply my trade, working with horses. But it was the best thing I ever did, and the rest is history.
So that afternoon at Fulton Hogan might have been a turning point in your life.
You're always learning something. You might not be learning what to do, you might be learning what not to do, but you're always learning something.
Exactly right. And on that note, mate, you said you went to university. I know you got a double degree in accounting and finance and also a Bachelor of Arts in economics. I must say, I don't really even understand what that means, but does that help you out with your business today? And obviously I'm assuming to get all that, you obviously got to work hard at your education and put a bit of hard work into that as well. So yeah, does that help you out with your business today or?
It certainly does. I enjoyed school. I wasn't someone who didn't like school. I enjoyed school. I mean, I enjoyed it for the social side of school, but I didn't find the work difficult, and I did like doing it. And uni was a natural progression. Those qualifications I have never used in a practical sense. I've never worked in an accounting firm or anything like that. But these concepts have helped me understand how a business needs to be run, which is an important part of training. I mean, people want not only the nuts and bolts or the bookwork side of things, but just in general, people want good communication. People want good systems in place. They want a sharp operator in charge of their horses, and those skills, mainly in terms of planning time and working towards deadlines. You do a lot of that at university. You get lumped with big fat projects that need to be done. A lot of people procrastinate them and do them at the last minute. But learning the skill of being able to manage your time as you're going along is something that's really important. So university really taught me that, and probably prepared me for life outside of those institutionalized environments. It was, and you had to do it yourself. There's no one at university telling you got to do it, or you're going to sit in the naughty corner like what you have at school. You've got to do it of your own volition, and if you don't try it, you'll get a C. And if you try kind of, you'll get a B. And if you work really hard, you get an A. So it's like it's actually a really straightforward lesson in what life is like. And that's what happens when you go training. If you can put in the hard yards and set your business up well, you can have success. And I haven't had enough success yet, but I'm you know, and that's my mindset. I'm intent on growing the business, having clients to enjoy racing horses at the best level. And if we can't race them at the best level, we win races and have fun along the way.
Fantastic mindset, and obviously, you're obviously growing in the right direction, and the business is a good pointer of that. So on that note, I know you went through the Godolphin Flying Start program. Was that sort of something that you found? And obviously, did you move to Australia for that program, or you're already out here in Australia? And what was involved in that program? Was that where you sort of learnt, how to be around horses and all that type of thing? Or what did you learn from that program and things like that?
Yeah, it was real icing on the cake. So the Godolphin was called the Darley Flying Start then, but the Godolphin Flying Start now is it's a 2-year international management training program specifically for the thoroughbred industry. It's actually a charity. So Sheikh Mohammed, who's the ruler of Dubai and the president of the United Arab Emirates, and obviously owns Godolphin. Any horses you see in those blue colours throughout the world are his horses. He's got a huge passion for racing and has invested heavily in the industry and supported countries and people in terms of his support behind racing, mostly in England, but that has really filtered down to Australia since he purchased the Inghams Empire in 2008. He had a huge present, and before he raced in the blue colours and he raced in the maroon colours. If anyone remembers sepoy racing, helmet and sepoy, that's a bit of a blast from the past, but I'm sure many would remember that. Peter Snowden, when he was training for Sheikh Mohammed, won all 5 2-year-old races, group ones in the season. So he won the blue diamond, he won the golden slipper, the sires, and the champagne. He won the JJ Atkins, I think it was called Benfica, I might be wrong, but they all ended up going to stud. So Sheikh Mohammed's investment in the industry has been huge, and arguably his biggest contribution will be the Flying Start, which is a charity. So for 2 years, I was one of 12 selected from around the world. I had to apply. It was sort of a rigorous process, and you go around Godolphin's different locations in the world. You do a mix of university and practical work. They planned the whole thing. I was the 10th intake, and they're still doing it now. They would be up to the 20 something intake. So it's been a big charitable gift to the racing industry. And Jim Clark, my bloodstock agent, did the program, and that's how I met him. We're both graduates of the program. I hooked up with him. He got me my job at Bjørn Baker's. He had the job there, and yeah, I think the alumni network is a big part of its strength, but also the fact that they're trying to teach you at that higher level. And they were hard taskmasters, but it was good for us. And yeah, we had an eye-opening experience of the global industry, which I would never have had but for that. I wouldn't be able to tell you who the leading stallion is in America if I hadn't been on the Flying Start. I have any appreciation of dirt racing, the breeding industry over there. I mean, a lot of people don't know America, sort of in the 50s and 60s, that's where it was at. That's where horse racing was at. And they had the best bred horses in the world, and to a certain extent, they still do, although they probably have been slightly overtaken by Japan.
Yeah, nice. I know I've heard along my time of so many successful people involved in the industry that have been through that Godolphin Flying Start program, and obviously young people coming through now that go through the program, start off as strappers, and then come up through to be racing managers and assistants. And obviously you're one of those guys, and I think this is probably the exciting part for me talking to you ahead now about your experience with a couple of trainers in our country. Three of our most successful trainers, biggest stables in the country, and it obviously all started off for you with Bjørn Baker Racing, and I know you were Bjørn's assistant slash racing manager. So how did that all come about? And obviously there's that Kiwi connection there, which is great. But yeah, how did it all first come about, your first sort of journey with Bjørn?
Was Murray, and but I'd never met Bjørn, and I was on the Flying Start. I met him in the winning owner's room at Rose Hill. So Off the Rails had won on a Saturday at Rose Hill, and Berbero had won. So Bjorn Baker was feeling jovial, and we were down there, and we'd been to his stables maybe like a couple of weeks before, and I had met him there, and he saw me, and I went and had a beer with him, and we chatted away, and it was really good. And about sort of 3 or 4 months later, him and Jim Clark was leaving the role of racing manager there for Bjorn, and they had put their heads together in the office and said, "Who do we want?" So at the time, I was in Dubai and I was still on the flying start. I was doing a work placement with Mike de Kock, and I received a phone call from Bjorn saying that, "What was I doing when the course was over?" So at this stage, it's sort of February, March, and the course is over in the June and July. And would I be interested in and flying back to have a week with them and seeing how the whole place operated? And if I was what he expected me to be, then there might be a job there for me. So that's how I got on to Bjorn, and I had an awesome run with him. He was my introduction to Sydney racing. He was my introduction to the coal face of what a racing stable was like, the hard yards that are required. Early days, Bjorn Baker was in there at 3 o'clock in the morning taking temperatures and putting hay over box doors and scrubbing water buckets out. So he's a real, he's an inspirational character. And Bjorn and how much he enjoys himself, and he does enjoy himself. Don't let that fool you. He is the ultimate work hard, play hard. He is the ultimate. There is no one more on the ball at 3 o'clock in the morning and ready to punch it out than him. And he gets his work done quick and fast. And he's a structured person. He's a smart man. He's university educated. He's been able to build a very successful business, but he's also been able to understand horses. And I think that's sort of bred into him through his father, Murray Baker. And I must say, I'm really enjoying seeing his exceptional run that he's having, because this was always going to happen. For those of us who have known Bjorn a while, he was always going to get to the top three or four in that Sydney Trainers Premiership. He just had it in him to do that. And when I was with him, he'd just had unencumbered, and he was getting a little influx of better yearlings, but he wasn't getting near the level that he is now. And it's very pleasing to see that he's getting good horses, and look what he's able to do with them. He's just winning left, right, and centre.
Oh, the stable's absolutely flying at the moment. They have an incredible record, and the horses are delivering. And I think it's really cool to hear, actually, because obviously, racing fans like myself and young people out there, we see on the Instagram and the social media, and Bjorn's quite active on it and gets here and does the lives and stuff like that. You see the funny side and Bjorn celebrating races. But you do sometimes think, oh, I wonder what he if he's up there at 3 in the morning doing those types of things. So that's really cool to hear. And I know you've obviously still got a really good relationship with Bjorn, because I do believe after they took out the 2-year-old Magic Millions, I think you were looking after OLA maybe at your stables there for a day or two, or helping the
Yeah,
team out before.
absolutely. Yeah, no, I keep his Queensland runners with me. So in the Winter Carnival, we had Steffi Magnetica came and lived with us for 6 weeks and did her thing. And Allegron won the Brisbane Cup. He was with us. And yeah, Olay came up for the Magic Millions. We had a bit of a delay there with our rained off, and we kept her for sort of a week more than what we were going to. But she was with us for 10 days, 2 weeks, and it's. I have that relationship with Bjorn. He's a big help to me. Not only sort of taught me how I should be operating, what I should be doing, but we do have sort of a continuous relationship. We talk quite a lot. I had rugby down there for a maiden at Warwick Farm on Wednesday, and I went down there and stayed with him. And it's a really good little thing that we can bounce off each other. And I've certainly learned a lot from him in my time. And it's a bit of a thrill to have those horses, and my staff love it too, because they get to ride good horses. I mean, I've got some nice handy horses, but I don't have Steffi Magnetica and OLA. So for my track riders that get on and gallop the Magic Millions winner before it wins the Magic Millions, very special to them, and for the ground staff as well. I've had my staff have strapped Brisbane Cup winners and Stradbroke winners and Magic Millions winners, thanks to Bjorn, and they absolutely love it. Listed winners, he had a couple of lower grade winners up here as well. That had won races, and they just really enjoy having those horses in the stable, and it's a big kick for everyone to do, and it's sort of the least I can do for Bjorn as well.
Yeah, that's awesome. And like you said before about relationships, you guys, as you said, Bjorn sending horses up to Queensland, they're winning, so you got to take a little bit of credit for that too. But just having that relationship with each other and being able to sort of work off each other and use that, your facilities in Queensland and he's in Sydney, so that's fantastic. And Yeah, awesome. And the Bjorn Baker stable was fine, as you said. But from there, you went and worked with another pretty successful Kiwi trainer in Chris Waller. I think you might have been Chris Waller's right-hand man there for a little bit of time as well. So how did that come about, and what can you tell us about Chris?
I'd had a good long stint with Bjorn and things were going really well, but Liam Pryor had left Wallers or was leaving Wallers. And so I was essentially approached to take his job. So the way it worked is Charlie Duckworth, who you would all see on the telly, is Chris's main man. And so he was sort of to fill the main man role, and I was going to be Charlie's 2IC. So that was the way that worked. Chris has obviously got a huge stable that runs length and breadth for country, and he really essentially has three racing managers at any one time. And he sort of got Charlie, that I would describe as he sits at the right hand of the father. Basis, he's extremely catered. He was a mate of mine from Sydney early days. So we got on well, and it was a good fit. So I went and did that. I spent a year there. It was a great year. And to see how he works and how he operates is something, quite different. He's got a lot of horses, and he was probably the one that taught me how to manage volume. He has systems in place to cater for such a huge number of horses, and everyone sort of thinks, oh well, the horse will disappear into the abyss at Waller Racing, but it kind of doesn't. He streamlined his whole thing. We'd be in the office on a Tuesday, and he'd be like, you need to bring up, the Doomben and Barra trials. You've got to watch them all. I want you to bring them up back to back. Watch them back to back. And righto, into this horse and that this horse in that race, and he's got it all sorted. He's got his systems, and those types of systems have really assisted me as my business grew, because I had it set up to train volume from the beginning, even though I wasn't. And as I've grown and got more horses, I've been able to deliver what I've needed to for each horse as the volume has stepped up. And that's something really important, and that's something that Chris does really well. And he may not be, I mean, I suppose the fashionable trainers may have slightly moved on from Chris, but there's not going to be any substitute for his expertise. And you will find every spring carnival and every autumn carnival, he will train a stack of Group One winners, because he just does. He just delivers them every time. He's got a sense of timing about him, and he's very calm and level, and he doesn't change, and he doesn't panic.
Yeah, absolutely. And obviously, I know a lot of racing fans recently would have been able to watch that Winx documentary about Chris. And like you said, you can see a little bit of background in about Chris there, and his reserved nature. And obviously, what an incredible journey that Winx story was. That was really exciting. And mate, lastly, you went and you moved on again to Kieran Maher Racing, which is another feather in your cap. And obviously, if you took a little bit out of each one of these trainers, the way they work, then I think you've set yourself up for a bright future yourself. And I believe over at Kieran Maher Stable, you were in charge of the Sydney stable, or head of the Sydney stable. Is that right?
Yeah, correct. So this was another very sort of sudden thing that happened. Annabelle Neesham went training, so she'd been running Sydney. She set up Sydney. Annabelle set up Sydney for Karen. They were very close, and she turned that stable really into what it is now, and certainly what it was when it originally started growing. She came up with two or three horses from Melbourne, and she started off. So by the time she got the offer to go training, there was 50 horses there. And it was fairly well established, and she was leaving, and the Karen required a replacement to run the stable, so that's where I came in. So it was another quite quick thing. I was approached to do the job, and I sort of had this, I had to choose that I want to, try and take the next level and essentially move from a racing manager role to what would I would consider a proper assistant trainer. So Karen is the trainer, is the boss, it's his system, it's his call, but you are more managing the day-to-day running of the stable a little bit more than what you are when you're a racing manager. Racing manager, you sort of, but predominantly you're going to the races, you're doing the noms, you're sort of programming things for a trainer, but you're not, that level of responsibility doesn't exist. So I probably considered Kieran Maher's the greatest dry run for training that there is. You've sort of got all the, he slips you enough rein, so to speak, but he's always there, like he's a phone call away. And I'd had an expensive colt that I had told him I was having troubles with his soundness, and he was at the Moonee Valley races on a Friday night. He was there at 4 o'clock on Saturday morning. So he's was always so close to help you. But at the same time, he was happy to let you make the call, happy for you to justify, do it within his thought processes and how he operated. So he's a very good horse person. He's a great man. He's like Rain Man. He can memorize what feeds they're on, and he'd know their actions, and he'd know everything. He'd turn up and ride track work, and he would get on the horses, have a feel for them himself. He's a very hands-on man, a great horseman, and he's a bit the same. Watching the success he's had, he was sort of flying when I was there, but since I've left, he's won a Melbourne Cup, and he's really ticked off, I suppose, quite a few of those bucket list items. He's had Pride of Jenny, another horse he's managed absolutely superbly. And the other thing I probably thought with Karen, he could get big results from limited horses. That's probably what I got the most out of him, and that's probably a bit of a hidden merit in the way he trains, and people would not see that with something that you would have had in your care and said, this can't win, Karen, it needs greener pastures, I'm either going to sack it, or what do you want to do? And he'd be like, oh, look, just bring it down to Melbourne, we'll give it some time at the beach, we'll give it some time here, we'll do this, we'll do that, we'll see if we can get a win out of it. And he'd win its maiden, and then it would be on English digital being sold. But I felt that his ability to extract the maximum out of horses, and his ability to decide what they were good at. So in my first year there, or somebody in my second, he had a lot of 2-year-olds up and running. Everyone would say, oh, Karen's so good with all these 2-year-olds. He's got all these 2-year-olds up and running. Da, da, da. The success was not in what he had up and running, but it was what he'd chosen to push on with. So of the groups of 2-year-olds he'd selected and said, these are your early runs, these are your early ones, that's an early one, that's an early one, this should run before Christmas, that's going for a spell. It was his ability to sort them into those groups, identify horses like Cool and Gadda, who was not your typical early running 2-year-old. She was a little bit soft physically. She wasn't a heavy horse. She wasn't a robust horse. She wasn't a strong horse. She was a natural horse, but she was weak. And he identified her natural talent, and he managed her to win a Magic Millions. And really, she was not a horse that I had pegged in the early groups at that time. But that's probably my biggest learning experience for him. It's sort of, if it walks like a duck and quacks like a duck and swims like a duck, it's a duck. And you can have the confidence to go with that. And he would say, this horse can run the time, Jack. What do you mean it's not a 2-year-old? And he got her there through his own good management and his own skills as a trainer. So yeah, that's probably the one thing that really sticks with me about how Kieran operates and what he does. And now that I'm outside of the system and I watch him with horses and I watch the way he places them and what he says about them on the telly, I kind of have a better appreciation of who he is and how he works.
It's obviously a really crucial thing in the training game with those horses. Obviously, especially stables like Kieran's, where they get a number of these yearlings in, they're very, very expensive. They're bloody, got really nice pedigrees behind them, but they're all different. Some are ready to go early, and some aren't. And I suppose, you probably can make a mistake, at the start of their careers and things like that. And my understanding is, regarding Kieran Maher, is that he's pretty big on the data and, the GPS tracking and horses and their bloods and all that type of thing. Was he big on the data back then when you were there, and you noticed that was different to Bjorn Baker Racing and Chris Waller as well? Or
Yeah,
what can you tell us there?
absolutely. Absolutely. He was really big on that when I arrived. And he was probably at the start of my time there, he was sort of finding his way and how it would work. He was big on using it, but he was probably finding his way in terms of how he would use it. And that's really, the chickens are coming home to roost now with all that early work that he was doing. And he was big into heart rates and fitness levels, and probably more so just monitoring each horse. And you've got your eye to monitor a horse. You've got a feed bin to monitor a horse. You've got a thermometer to monitor a horse. But he would also have the set of data that would run alongside, and not so much looking for X as a champion and Y as a dud. It's not that simple. But looking for a horse who hits continual benchmarks and then all of a sudden doesn't, that's a sign something is not where it should be, even if you can't pick it up to the eye. Or a horse who used to punch around here at this sort of level and is now up here, maybe things are changing, maybe they're getting fitter, maybe they can stretch out and distance a bit more, or something like that. So he was more about building a consistent line on each individually trained and having it sort of run alongside what he was doing, and he'd be dipping in and dipping out, and he wouldn't be living and dying by the data, but if he was unsure, he would be going there for an extra set of eyes, I suppose, on his horses.
Yeah, just a really nice tool to have and add to the training part of the game, mate. So obviously from there you obviously left Kiramar and you opened up your stable, and I know you started at Deegan. You had a number of boxes there, and then I think you might be able to correct me there, but I think you might have around 60 stables at the sunny coast now. Is that correct?
Yeah,
And
30, 30 and 30. So I've got 60 in total, and I'm split evenly across those two locations. So my two stables sort of run as they're both fully functional racing stables, and they're just in different locations. So the main thing that I get out of that is I have multiple facilities, and I have those economies of scale to be able to bounce horses back and forwards. I bounce a lot of the older geldings back and forwards. I bounce a lot of the younger horses back and forwards, and hey, one spot and doesn't bother. But for those horses that exist outside of that 80%, being able to accommodate them and win a race with them is something that I can give those horses that maybe they can't get elsewhere, or something that I can give them that maybe they have not had. So it's really important to, from my point of view, to be able to offer that. And I've also got access to a farm and sort of the Sunshine Coast, inland of the Sunshine Coast there. So those three elements, I've got these things working alongside each other, and I can freshen horses up. I can these if I decide that a horse needs X, I need to be able to do it for them and not be able to say, oh, sorry guys, I can't do that, I can't help your horse. So I think that's important, especially with the bread and butter horses, the stocking fillers, these tried horses that come to me. You could do something different to get the maximum out of them, and the multiple facilities thing is something that gives me a competitive advantage that maybe my competitors do not have.
Yeah, that's absolutely awesome. And like you said, with these tried horses, sometimes these tried horses just need a bit of a change of environment, a bit of a spark up. And with you able to take them down the beach and give them that type of thing, and also mix them between your own stables, that's really great. And obviously the facilities at both Deegan and Sunshine Coast are excellent. So that's fantastic, mate. And obviously just on the stable, obviously I know firsthand. We've got a horse together, and I'm sure we're gonna have more together in the future, but you're really big on honesty and transparency with the owners, and I can vouch for the level of communication from yourself to owners is absolutely top notch. So I'll give you credit for that. And I think honesty is a big thing in the game. Owners want to know how the horses are going, but they don't want to just be told that it's going great and this and that. They want honesty. So I think that's fantastic. And you've got a wide crew of ownership now, and I know you've got horses with Calibre Racing, Patriot Bloodstock, Champion Thoroughbreds now, as well as Triple J Racing, which means you're working with a lot of syndicators and lots of great owners. So everything's going in the right direction. But where do you see the stable in another 12 to 18 months? Or what are you striving for?
Well, I'm looking to, at the moment, I'm sort of looking to, I think my base of 60 boxes is a fairly reasonable base to have, and that's sort of settling in now, and it's finding its nice rhythm. So mainly I'm looking to win more metropolitan races. That's really what I'm about, and I want to win more metro races, and I want to buy yearlings to find the next champion, and that's what I'm looking for. And if I can win stakes races along the way in that journey, that's what I'm after. So I suppose improving the stock that's coming in the door is a big part of it, but at the same time, you have to keep your systems clean, you have to keep them perfect, you have to get the maximum out of each horse that you get to train. So there's sort of an individual focus there with each horse of trying to get the maximum out of it and making sure I'm doing everything I can for each horse, and then zooming out and looking at the bigger picture of my stable, who I am and where I want to go. But I do want to be training metropolitan winners. I want to be in that top 10 on the metro list sort of as soon as I can, and once I get into that top 10, I want to be pushing into the top 5 and top 3, and then sort of on from there. Like it's a good game played slowly, and I don't expect any of that success overnight. I'm sort of fortunate to have Bjorn as a very good, clear reality check in terms of what you have to do to be successful. But I think working in that direction is great. Wherever we are at the moment, that's cool. But it's about working towards that. And if we're getting the maximum out of every horse we get given, and we're aiming at those metropolitan races and trying to win those, that's a big KPI. And you mentioned it before, my place strike rate. So if I'd drawn some better gates and run on some more suitable tracks recently, I'd probably have a slightly better win rate. But having them run top three is really crucial. That means they're in the right races and they're looking good, they're feeling well, they're running well. If they're running in the top three, that is when you know the horse is going well. So recently I've had a few hard lucks. I think I had a run of 12 placings in between winners. So I had a winner and I had 6 seconds, 6 thirds mixed in with each other, and another winner. So it was a bit, I've had a bit of a frustrating time. That's probably the last sort of 3 weeks. The horses are running well, and then it's just a matter of time. They start drawing well, the tracks suit them, and then bang, 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 they're away. They get good rides and they're away. And you'll go through a run of going really, really well when all those little things click. And then you'll get a few shocking rides on horses that could win, and you'll be back having not trained a winner in your last 10 starters. But it's a good game. It ebbs and flows, and I really enjoy it.
There's always a reality check around the corner when the stable's going well, which just kicks you back into gear and makes you think, oh, geez, I'm not going as good as I thought I was. But nah, it's a fun game, mate. And as you said, your place strike rate is phenomenal for a stable that only started back in May 2022, and you're getting better quality horses now. You're getting more owners on board, so I'm sure that's just going to get better and better. And we'll see you in the bigger and bigger races. And also, as you alluded to, you've worked with some great people in the game, and they're all hard workers, and they've all got the same workout that you do. So, I think it's going to be perfect. And on that note, mate, owners listening in, they can go on jackbruceracing.com.au, check out the horses available. They can give you a call at any time and have a discussion and things like that.
Yeah, absolutely. My website's there, and I'm actually in the process of redeveloping it at the moment. It's another exciting opportunity that I'm creating. But in any case, yeah, look, anyone can jump online, jackbruceracing.com.au, and check it out. I've got horses listed there for sale. My number's on the website. Give me a call if you want to talk racing, or you want to discuss getting involved in my stable. And I'd love to have anybody and everybody on board. And I think people sometimes approach ownership with a little bit of a, oh, I'm not really sure if I can go into a horse, or I should be, or whatever. We've sort of got a lot to suit all types of A, budgets, and B, levels of interest that you want to have. So whether you don't want to muck around and you want the top level and you want to buy a big chunk and go in that sort of level and play it seriously and play it in a sort of a dedicated way like that, or you've just got a group of mates and you want to share in a horse so you can go to the pub and kick it home, like, perfect. We're all wanting something, and we can facilitate that, like, as trainers and as yourself as a syndicator, you can facilitate that at any level. So the main thing to do if you want to get involved in horses, just reach out. It's a lot easier than you think. Once you dial that number or you flick through an email, it all flows from there, and it's easier to get involved than a lot of people imagine. So and on that note, Jared, what you're creating with your syndication company is the same thing. You're trying to get people involved to race horses. People can enjoy horse racing more than they realize, and if they haven't owned a winner yet, they need to live and breathe it. And anyway, if they watch me kick one home at Dalby from the office, they'd soon learn, and it's the same. So if you want to get involved in horses, it's more fun than you would imagine. The social side of it, and the enjoyment side of it, and the camaraderie that you get from racing horses with groups of people, second to none. So, yeah, if anyone wants to get involved, absolutely just reach out and we'll get you kicked off.
There's absolutely nothing better than being not only trackside and cheering home a winner, but being at the pub, a couple of schooners with the mates, whatever. You're all on the same horse. It's fantastic. And then, if you get involved in ownership and get a crew together, like you said, a syndicate and things like that, it's fantastic. So, mate, I really appreciate your time today. And, thanks for taking time out of your busy schedule. And I wish you all the best with your runners over the weekend and also the future.
Awesome. Thanks, Jared. Cheers. Thanks for having me.
Cheers, mate.